Suddenly the words of the spell froze on his lips, and his heart went cold within him. He looked back over his shoulder. The shadow stood behind him in the boat. Had he lost one instant, he had been lost. But he was ready, and lunged to seize and hold the thing which wavered and trembled there within arm's reach. No wizardry would serve him now, but only his own flesh, his life itself against the unliving. He spoke no word, but attacked, and the boat plunged and pitched from his sudden turn and lunge, and a pain ran up his arms into his breast, taking away his breath, and an icy cold filled him, and he was blinded. Yet in his hands that seized the shadow there was nothing. Darkness. Air. He stumbled forward, catching the mast to stay his fall, and light came shooting back into his eyes. He saw the shadow shudder away from him and shrink together and then stretch hugely up over him, over the sail for an instant, and then, like black smoke on the wind, it recoiled and fled, formless, down the water towards the bright gate between the cliffs. Ged sank to his knees. The little spell-patched boat pitched again, rocked itself to stillness, drifting on the uneasy waves. He crouched in it, numb, unthinking, struggling to draw breath, until at last cold water welling under his hands warned him that he must see to his boat, for the spells binding it were growing weak. He stood up, holding onto the staff that made the mast, and rewove the binding spell as best he could. He was chilled and weary. His hands and arms ached sorely, and there was no power in him. He wished he might lie down there, in that dark place where sea and mountain met, and sleep on the restless rocking water. He could not tell if this weariness were a sorcery laid on him by the shadow as it fled, or came of the bitter coldness of its touch, or was from mere hunger, or was fear and want of sleep and expensive strength. But he struggled against it, forcing himself to raise up a light mage wind into the sail and follow down the dark seaway where the shadow had fled. All terror was gone. All joy was gone. It was a chase no longer. He was neither hunted nor hunter now. For the third time they had met and touched, he had of his own will turned to the shadow, seeking to hold it with living hands. He had not held it, but he had forged between them a bond, a link that had no breaking point. There was no need to hunt the thing down, to track it, nor would its flight avail it. Neither could escape. When they had come to the time and place for their last meeting, they would meet. But until that time, and elsewhere than that place, there would never be any rest or peace for Ged, day or night, on earth or sea. He knew now, and the knowledge was hard, that his task had never been to undo what he had done, but to finish what he had begun. He sailed out from between the dark cliffs, and on the sea was broad, bright morning with a fair wind blowing from the north. He drank what water he had left in the sealskin pouch, and steered around the westernmost headland until he came into a wide strait between it and a second island lying to the west. Then he knew the place, calling to mind sea charts of the East Reach. These were the Hands, a pair of lonely isles that reached their mountain fingers northward toward the Kharged lands. He sailed on between the two, and as the afternoon darkened with storm clouds coming up from the north, he came to shore on the southern coast of the West Isle. He had seen there was a little village there above the beach where a stream came tumbling down to the sea, and he cared little what welcome he got if he could have water, fire's warmth, and sleep. The villagers were rough, shy people, awed by a wizard's staff, wary of a strange face, but hospitable to one who came alone, over sea, before a storm. They gave him meat and drink in plenty, and the comfort of firelight and the comfort of human voices speaking his own Hardic tongue, and last and best they gave him hot water to wash the cold and saltness of the sea from him, and a bed where he could sleep. Chapter 9. Iffish. Ged spent 3 days in that village of the West Hand, recovering himself, and making ready a boat built not of spells and sea-rack, but of sound wood well-pegged and caulked, with a stout mast and sail of her own that he might sail easily and sleep when he needed. Like most boats of the north and the reaches, she was clinker-built, with planks overlapped and clenched one upon the other for strength in the high seas. Every part of her was sturdy and well-made. Ged reinforced her wood with deep inwoven charms, for he thought he might go far in that boat. She was built to carry 2 or 3 men, and the old man who owned her said that he and his brothers had been through high seas and foul weather with her, and she had ridden all gallantly. Unlike the shrewd fishermen of Gaunt, this old man, for fear and wonder of his wizardry, would have given the boat to Ged. But Ged paid him for it in sorcerer's kind, healing his eyes of the cataracts that were in the way of blinding him. Then the old man, rejoicing, said to him, "We called the boat Sanderling, but do you call her Lookfar, and paint eyes aside her prow, and my thanks will look out of that blind wood for you, and keep you from rock and reef. For I had forgotten how much light there is in the world, till you gave it back to me." Other works Ged also did in his days in that village, under the steep forests of the Hand, as his power came back into him. These were such people as he had known as a boy in the northward vale of Gaunt, though poorer even than those. With them he was at home, as he would never be in the courts of the wealthy, and he knew their bitter wants without having to ask. So he laid charms of heal and ward on children who were lame or sickly, and spells of increase on the villagers' scrawny flocks of goats and sheep. He set the rune Simn on the spindles and looms, the boat's oars and tools of bronze and stone they brought him, that these might do their work well. And the rune Perr he wrote on the roof-trees of the huts, which protects the house and its folk from fire, wind, and madness. When his boat Lookfar was ready and well stocked with water and dried fish, he stayed yet one more day in the village to teach to their young chanter the deed of Morred and the Havnorian lay. Very seldom did any archipelagan ship touch at the Hands. Songs made 100 years ago were news to those villagers, and they craved to hear of heroes. Had Ged been free of what was laid on him, he would gladly have stayed there a week or a month to sing them what he knew, that the great songs might be known on a new isle. But he was not free, and the next morning he set sail, going straight south over the wide seas of the Reach, for southward the shadow had gone. He need cast no finding charm to know this. He knew it as certainly as if a fine, unreeling cord bound him and it together, no matter what miles and seas and lands might lie between. So he went, certain, unhurried, and unhopeful on the way he must go, and the wind of winter bore him to the south. He sailed a day and a night over the lonesome sea, and on the second day he came to a small isle, which they told him was called Vemish. The people of the little port looked at him askance, and soon their sorcerer came hurrying. He looked hard at Ged, and then he bowed, and said in a voice that was both pompous and wheedling, "Lord Wizard, forgive my temerity, and honor us by accepting of us anything you may need for your voyage. Food, drink, sailcloth, rope. My daughter is fetching to your boat at this moment a brace of fresh roasted hens. I think it prudent, however, that you continue on your way from here as soon as it meets your convenience to do so. The people are in some dismay food, drink, sailcloth, rope. My daughter is fetching to your boat at this moment a brace of fresh roasted hens. I think it prudent, however, that you continue on your way from here as soon as it meets your convenience to do so. The people are in some dismay, for not long ago, the day before yesterday, a person was seen crossing our humble isle afoot from north to south, and no boat was seen to come with him aboard it, nor no boat was seen to leave with him aboard it, and it did not seem that he cast any shadow. Those who saw this person tell me that he bore some likeness to yourself. At that, Ged bowed his own head and turned and went back to the docks of Vemish and sailed out, not looking back. There was no profit in frightening the islanders or making an enemy of their sorcerer. He would rather sleep at sea again and think over this news the sorcerer had told him, for he was sorely puzzled by it. The day ended and the night passed with cold rain whispering over the sea all through the dark hours and a gray dawn. Still the mild north wind carried look far on. After noon the rain and mist blew off and the sun shone from time to time, and late in the day Ged saw right athwart his course the low blue hills of a great island, brightened by that drifting winter sunlight. The smoke of hearth fires lingered blue over the slate roofs of little towns among those hills, a pleasant sight in the vast sameness of the sea. Ged followed a fishing fleet into their port, and going up the streets of the town in the golden winter evening, he found an inn called the Hareki, where firelight and ale and roast ribs of mutton warmed him body and soul. At the tables of the inn there were a couple of other voyagers, traders of the East Reach, but most of the men were townsfolk, come there for good ale, news, and conversation. They were not rough, timid people like the fisher folk of the Hands, but true townsmen, alert and sedate. Surely they knew Ged for a wizard, but nothing at all was said of it, except that the innkeeper, in talking, and he was a talkative man, mentioned that this town, Ismay, was fortunate in sharing with other towns of the island the inestimable treasure of an accomplished wizard trained at the school on Roke, who had been given his staff by the Archmage himself, and who, though out of town at the moment, dwelt in his ancestral home right in Ismay itself, which, therefore, stood in no need of any other practitioner of the high arts. As they say, two staffs in one town must come to blows, isn't it so, sir? Said the innkeeper, smiling and full of cheer. So Ged was informed that his journeyman wizard, one seeking a livelihood from sorcery, he was not wanted here. Thus he had got a blunt dismissal from Vemish and a bland one from Ismay, and he wondered at what he had been told about the kindly ways of the East Reach. This isle was Ifish, where his friend Vetch had been born. It did not seem so hospitable a place as Vetch had said. And yet he saw that they were, indeed, kindly faces enough. It was only that they sensed what he knew to be true, that he was set apart from them, cut off from them, that he bore a doom upon him and followed after a dark thing. He was like a cold wind blowing through the firelit room, like a black bird carried by on a storm from foreign lands. The sooner he went on, taking his evil destiny with him, the better for these folk. "I am on quest," he said to the innkeeper. I will be here only a night or two." His tone was bleak. The innkeeper, with a glance at the great yew staff in the corner, said nothing at all for once, but filled up Ged's cup with brown ale till the foam ran over the top. Ged knew that he should spend only the one night in Ismay. There was no welcome for him there, or anywhere. He must go where he was bound. But he was sick of the cold, empty sea and the silence where no voice spoke to him. He told himself he would spend one day in Ismay and on the morrow go. So he slept late. When he woke, a light snow was falling, and he idled about the lanes and byways of the town to watch the people busy at their doings. He watched children bundled in fur capes playing at Snow Castle and building snowmen. He heard gossips chatting across the street from open doors and watched the bronze smith at work with a little lad red-faced and sweating to pump the long bellows sleeves at the smelting pit. Through windows lit with a dim ruddy gold from within as the short day darkened, he saw women at their looms, turning a moment to speak or smile to child or husband there in the warmth within the house. Ged saw all these things from outside and apart, alone. And his heart was very heavy in him, though he would not admit to himself that he was sad. As night fell, he still lingered in the streets, reluctant to go back to the inn. He heard a man and a girl talking together merrily as they came down the street past him towards the town square, and all at once he turned, for he knew the man's voice. He followed and caught up with the pair, coming up beside them in the late twilight, lit only by distant lantern gleams. The girl stepped back, but the man stared at him and then flung up the staff he carried, holding it between them as a barrier to ward off the threat or act of evil. And that was somewhat more than Ged could bear. His voice shook a little as he said, "I thought you would know me, Vetch." Even then Vetch hesitated for a moment.
"I do know you," he said,
and lowered the staff and took Ged's hand and hugged him round the shoulders,
"I do know you. Welcome, my friend, welcome. What a sorry greeting I gave you, as if you were a ghost coming up from behind, and I have waited for you to come and looked for you.
So you are the wizard they boast of in Ismay. I wondered..."
"Oh, yes, yes, I'm their wizard, but listen, let me tell you why I didn't know you, lad. Maybe I've looked too hard for you. 3 days ago..."
"3 days ago? Were you here 3 days ago on Ifish?" I came yesterday."
"Hmm. 3 days ago, in the streets in Quar, the village up there in the hills, I saw you. That is, I saw a presentment of you, or an imitation of you, or maybe simply a man who looks like you. He was ahead of me going out of town, and he turned a bend in the road even as I saw him, and I called and got no answer. I followed and found no one, nor any tracks. But the ground was frozen, and it was a queer thing, and now, seeing you come up out of the shadows like that, I thought I was tricked again. I am sorry, Ged."
He spoke Ged's true name softly, so that the girl who stood waiting a little way behind him would not hear it. Ged also spoke low to use his friend's true name. "No matter, Asterio, but this is myself, and I am glad to see you." Vetch heard perhaps something more than simple gladness in his voice. He had not yet let go of Ged's shoulder, and he said now in the true speech,
"In trouble and from darkness you come, Ged, yet your coming is joy to me."
Then he went on in his reach-accented Hardik,
"Come on, come home with us. We're going home. It's time to get in out of the dark. This is my sister, the youngest of us, prettier than I am, as you see, but much less clever. Yarrow, this is the Sparrowhawk, the best of us, and my friend."
"Lord Wizard?"
The girl greeted him, and decorously she bobbed her head and hid her eyes with her hands to show respect, as women did in the East Reach. Her eyes, when not hidden, were clear, shy, and curious. She was perhaps 14 years old, dark like her brother, but very slight and slender. On her sleeve there clung, winged and taloned, a dragon, no longer than her hand. They set off down the dusky street together, and Ged remarked as they went along, "In Gaunt they say Gauntish women are brave, but I never saw a maiden there wore a dragon for a bracelet." This made Yarrow laugh, and she answered him straight, "This is only a Hareki. Have you no Hareki on Gaunt?" Then she got shy for a moment and hid her eyes. No dragons. Is that the creature a dragon?
A little one that lives in oak trees and eats wasps and worms and sparrows' eggs. It grows no greater than this. Oh, sir, my brother has told me often of the pet you had, the wild thing, the Otek. Do you have it still?"
No longer. Vetch turned to him as if with a question, but he held his tongue and asked nothing till much later, when the two of them sat alone over the stone fire pit of Vetch's house. Though he was the chief wizard in the whole island of Ifish, Vetch made his home in Ismay, this small town where he had been born, living with his youngest brother and sister. His father had been a sea trader of some means, and the house was spacious and strong-beamed, with much homely wealth of pottery and fine weaving, and vessels of bronze and brass on carven shelves and chests. A great Taonian harp stood in one corner of the main room, and Yarrow's tapestry loom in another, its tall frame inlaid with ivory. There Vetch, for all his plain, quiet ways, was both a powerful wizard and a lord in his own house. There were a couple of old servants prospering along with the house, and the brother, a cheerful lad, and Yarrow, quick and silent as a little fish, who served the two friends their supper and ate with them, listening to their talk, and afterwards slipped off to her own room. All things here were well-founded, peaceful, and assured. And Ged, looking about him at the firelit room, said, "This is how a man should live." And sighed.
"Well, it's one good way," said Vetch. "There are others. Now, lad, tell me if you can what things have come to you and gone from you since we last spoke. And tell me what journey you are on, since I see well that you won't stay long with us this time." Ged told him, and when he was done, Vetch sat pondering for a long while. Then he said, "I'll go with you, Ged."
"Oh, no.
I think I will."
"No, Estadio. No, this is no task or bane of yours. I began this evil course alone. I will finish it alone. I do not want any other to suffer from it, you least of all. You who tried to keep my hand from the evil act in the very beginning, Estario."
"Pride was ever your mind's master," his friend said, smiling as if they talked of a matter of small concern to either. "Now think. It is your quest, assuredly, but if the quest fail, should there not be another there who might bear warning to the archipelago? For the shadow would be a fearful power then, and if you defeat the thing, should there not be another there who will tell of it in the archipelago, that the deed may be known and sung? I know I can be of no use to you, yet I think I should go with you."
So entreated, Ged could not deny his friend, but he said, "I should not have stayed this day here. I knew it, but I stayed."
"Wizards do not meet by chance, lad. And after all, as you said yourself, I was with you at the beginning of your journey. It is right that I should follow you to its end."
He put new wood on the fire, and they sat gazing into the flames a while. There is one I have not heard of since that night on Roque Knoll, and I had no heart to ask any at the school of him. Jasper, I mean.
He never won his staff. He left Roque that same summer and went to the island of Oo to be sorcerer in the Lord's household at Ochtucknay. I know no more of him than that. More of him than that. More.
Again they were silent, watching the fire and enjoying, since it was a bitter night, the warmth on their legs and faces as they sat on the broad coping of the fire pit, their feet almost among the coals. Ged said at last, speaking low, "There is a thing that I fear, Estario. I fear it more if you're with me when I go. There in the hands, in the dead end of the inlet, I turned upon the shadow. It was within my hand's reach, and I seized it. I tried to seize it, and there was nothing I could hold. I could not defeat it. It fled. I followed. But that may happen again, and yet again I have no power over the thing. There may be neither death nor triumph to end this quest. Nothing to sing of. No end. It may be I must spend my life running from sea to sea and land to land on an endless vain venture. A shadow quest?"
"Avert," said Vetch, turning his left hand in the gesture that turns aside the ill chance spoken of. For all his somber thoughts, this made Ged grin a little, for it is rather a child's charm than a wizard's. There was always such village innocence in Vetch. Yet also he was keen, shrewd, direct to the center of a thing. He said now, "That is a grim thought, and I trust a false one. I guess rather that what I saw begin, I may see end. Somehow you will learn its nature, its being, what it is, and so hold and bind and vanquish it. Though that is a hard question, what is it? There is a thing that worries me. I do not understand it. It seems the shadow now goes in your shape, or a kind of likeness of you, at least, as they saw it on Vemish and as I saw it here in Ifish. How may that be, and why did it never do so in the archipelago?"
"They say rules change in the reaches."
"Aye, a true saying, I can tell you. There are good spells I learned on Roque that have no power here, or go all awry. And also there are spells worked here I never learned on Roque. Every land has its own powers, and the farther one goes from the inner lands, the less one can guess about those powers and their governance. But I do not think it is only that. which works this change in the shadow.
Nor do I. I think that when I cease to flee from it and turned against it, that turning of my will upon it gave it shape and form, even though the same act prevented it from taking my strength from me. All my acts have their echo in it. It is my creature.
In Uskill it named you, and so stopped any wizardry you might have used against it. Why did it not do so again there in the hands?
I do not know. Perhaps it is only from my weakness that it draws the strength to speak. Almost with my own tongue it speaks. For how did it know my name? How did it know my name? I have racked my brains on that over all the seas since I left Gaunt, and I cannot see the answer. Maybe it cannot speak at all in its own tongue or formlessness, but only with borrowed tongue as a gebeth. I do not know.
Then you must beware meeting it in gebeth form a second time.
I think, Ged replied, stretching out his hands to the red coals, as if he felt an inward chill, I think I will not. It is bound to me now as I am to it. It cannot get so far free of me as to seize any other man and empty him of will and being as it did Skyr. It can possess me. If ever I weaken again and try to escape from it to break the bond, it will possess me. And yet when I held it with all the strength I had, it became mere vapor and escaped from me, and so it will again. And yet it cannot really escape, for I can always find it. I am bound to the foul, cruel thing, and will be forever, unless I can learn the word that masters it, its name.
Brooding, his friend asked, Are there names in the Dark Realms?
Gensha the Archmage said there are not. My master Ogion said otherwise.
Infinite are the arguments of mages, Vetch quoted with a smile that was somewhat grim. She who served the old power on Oskill swore that the stone would tell me the shadow's name, but that I count for little. However, there was also a dragon who offered to trade that name for his own to be rid of me, and I have thought that where mages argue, dragons may be wise?
Wise but unkind. But what dragon is this? You did not tell me you had been talking with dragons since I saw you last.
They talked together late that night, and though always they came back to the bitter matter of what lay before Ged, yet their pleasure in being together overrode all. For the love between them was strong and steadfast, unshaken by time or chance. In the morning, Ged woke beneath his friend's roof, and while he was still drowsy, he felt such well-being as if he were in some place wholly defended from evil and harm. All day long, a little of this dream peace clung to his thoughts, and he took it not as a good omen, but as a gift. It seemed likely to him that leaving this house, he would leave the last haven he was to know, and so, while the short dream lasted, he would be happy in it. Having affairs he must see to before he left Ifish, Vetch went off to other villages of the island with the lad who served him as prentice sorcerer. Ged stayed with Yarrow and her brother, called Mura, who was between her and Vetch in age. He seemed not much more than a boy, for there was no gift or scourge of mage power in him, and he had never been anywhere but Ifish, talk and hope, and his life was easy and untroubled. Ged watched him with wonder and some envy, and exactly so he watched Ged. To each it seemed very queer that the other, so different, yet was his own age, 19 years. Ged marveled how one who had lived 19 years could be so carefree. Admiring Mura's comely, cheerful face, he felt himself to be all lank and harsh, never guessing that Mura envied him even the scars that scored his face, and thought them the track of a dragon's claws and the very rune and sign of a hero. The two young men were thus somewhat shy with each other, but as for Yarrow, she soon lost her awe of Ged, being in her own house and mistress of it. He was very gentle with her, and many were the questions she asked of him, for Vetch, she said, would never tell her anything.
She kept busy those 2 days making dry wheat cakes for the voyagers to carry, and wrapping up dried fish and meat and other such provender to stock their boat, until Ged told her to stop, for he did not plan to sail clear to Celador without a halt.
Where is Celador?
It's very far out in the western reach, where dragons are as common as mice.
Oh,
best stay in the east, then. Our dragons are as small as mice. There's your meat, then. You're sure that's enough? Listen, I don't understand. You and my brother both are mighty wizards. You wave your hand and mutter, and the thing is done.
Why do you get hungry, then?
When it comes supper time at sea, why not say, meat pie? And the meat pie appears, and you eat it.
Well, we could do so, but we don't much wish to eat our words, as they say. Meat pie is only a word, after all. We can make it odorous and savorous and even filling, but it remains a word. It fools the stomach and gives no strength to the hungry man.
Wizards, then, are not cooks,
said Mura, who was sitting across the kitchen hearth from Ged, carving a box lid of fine wood. He was a woodworker by trade, though not a very zealous one.
Nor are cooks wizards, alas,
said Yarrow, on her knees to see if the last batch of cakes baking on the hearth bricks was getting brown.
But I still don't understand, Sparrowhawk.
I have seen my brother, and even his prentice, make light in a dark place only by saying one word,
and the light shines. It is bright. Not a word, but a light you can see your way by.
I get answered. Light is a power, a great power by which we exist, but which exists beyond our needs in itself. Sunlight and starlight are time, and time is light. In the sunlight, in the days and years, life is. In a dark place, life may call upon the light, naming it, but usually, when you see a wizard name or call upon something, some object to appear, that is not the same. He calls upon no power greater than himself, and what appears is an illusion only. To summon a thing that is not there at all, to call it by speaking its true name, that is a great mastery, not lightly used, not for mere hunger's sake. Yarrow, your little dragon has stolen a cake. Yarrow had listened so hard, gazing at Ged as he spoke, that she had not seen the Hareki scuttle down from its warm perch on the kettle hook over the hearth and seize a wheat cake bigger than itself. And she took the small, scaly creature on her knee and fed it bits and crumbs while she pondered what Ged had told her.
So then, you would not summon up a real meat pie, lest you disturb what my brother's always talking about. I forget its name.
Equilibrium, Ged replied soberly, for she was very serious.
Yes, yes, but when you were shipwrecked, you sailed from the place in a boat woven, mostly of spells, and it didn't leak water.
Was it illusion?
Well, partly it was illusion, because I am uneasy seeing the sea through great holes in my boat, so I patched them for the looks of the thing. But the strength of the boat was not illusion, nor summoning, but made with another kind of art, a binding spell. The wood was bound as one whole, one entire thing, a boat. What is a boat but a thing that doesn't leak water?
I've bailed some that do, said Mura.
Well, mine leak too, unless I was constantly seeing to the spell.
He bent down from his corner seat and took a cake from the bricks and juggled it in his hands.
I, too, have stolen a cake. Well, you have burned fingers, then, and when you're starving on the wastewater between the Far Isles, you'll think of that cake and say, had I not stolen that cake, I might eat it now. Alas!
I shall eat my brother's, so he can starve with you. Thus is equilibrium maintained, Ged remarked, while she took and munched a hot half-toasted cake, and this made her giggle and choke. But presently, looking serious again, she said,
I wish I could truly understand what you tell me. I am too stupid.
Little sister, it is that I have no skill explaining. If we had more time...
We will have more time. When my brother comes back home, you will come with him for a while at least, won't you?
If I can, he answered gently. There was a little pause, and Yarrow asked, watching the Hareki climb back to its perch,
Tell me just this, if it is not a secret. What other great powers are there beside the light?
It is no secret. All power is one in source and end, I think. Years and distances, stars and candles, water and wind and wizardry, the craft in a man's hand and the wisdom in a tree's root, they all arise together. My name and yours and the true name of the sun or a spring of water or an unborn child, all are syllables of the great word that is very slowly spoken by the shining of the stars. There is no other power, no other name. Staying his knife on the carved wood, Mura asked, "What of death?" The girl listened, her shining black head bent down. "For a word to be spoken," Ged answered slowly, "there must be silence before and after." Then all at once he got up, saying, "I have no right to speak of these things. The word that was mine to say I said wrong. It is better that I keep still. I will not speak again. Maybe there is no true power but the dark." And he left the fireside and the warm kitchen, taking up his cloak and going out alone into the drizzling cold rain of winter in the streets. "He is under a curse," Mura said, gazing somewhat fearfully after him. "I think this voyage he is on leads him to his death," the girl said. "And he fears that. Yet he goes on." She lifted her head as if she watched, through the red flame of the fire, the course of a boat that came through the seas of winter alone and went on out into empty seas. Then her eyes filled with tears a moment, but she said nothing. Vetch came home the next day and took his leave of the notables of Ismay, who were most unwilling to let him go off to sea in midwinter on a mortal quest, not even his own. But though they might reproach him, there was nothing at all they could do to stop him. Growing weary of old men who nagged him, he said, "I am yours by parentage and custom and by duty undertaken towards you. I am your wizard, but it is time you recalled that though I am a servant, I am not your servant. When I am free to come back, I will come back. Until then, farewell." At daybreak, as gray light welled up in the east from the sea, the two young men set forth in Lukfar from the harbor of Ismay, raising a brown, strong-woven sail to the north wind. On the dock Yarro stood and watched them go, as sailors' wives and sisters stand on all the shores of all Earth's sea, watching their men go out on the sea, and they do not wave or call aloud, but stand still in hooded cloak of gray or brown, there on the shore that dwindles smaller and smaller from the boat, while the water grows wide between. The 10th and final chapter, The Open Sea. The haven now was sunk from sight, and Lukfar's painted eyes, wave-drenched, looked ahead on seas ever wider and more desolate. In 2 days and nights the companions made the crossing from Ifish to Sutter's Island, 100 miles of foul weather and contrary winds. They stayed in port there only briefly, long enough to refill a water-skin, and to buy a tar-smeared sailcloth to protect some of their gear in the undecked boat from seawater and rain. They had not provided this earlier, because ordinarily a wizard looks after such small conveniences by way of spells, the very least and commonest kind of spells, and indeed it takes little more magic to freshen seawater and so save the bother of carrying fresh water. But Ged seemed most unwilling to use his craft or to let Vetch use his. He said only, "It's better not," and his friend didn't ask or argue, for as the wind first filled their sail, both had felt a heavy foreboding, cold as that winter wind. Haven, harbor, peace, safety, all that was behind them. They had turned away. They went now a way in which all events were perilous, and no acts were meaningless. On the course on which they were embarked, the saying of the least spell might change chance and move the balance of power and of doom. For they went now toward the very center of that balance, toward the place where light and darkness meet. And those who travel thus say no word carelessly. Sailing out again, and coasting round the shores of Sutter's, where white snowfields faded up into foggy hills, Ged took the boat southward again, and now they entered waters where the great traders of the archipelago never come, the outmost fringes of the reach. Vetch asked no question about their course, knowing that Ged did not choose it, but went as he must go.
As Sutter's Island grew small and pale behind them, and the waves hissed and smacked under the prow, and the great gray plain of water circled them all round clear to the edge of the sky, Ged asked, "What lands lie ahead this course?"
"Due south of Sutter's there are no lands at all.
Southeast you go a long way and find little. Pelimer, Cornay, Gosk, and Nastawell, which is also called Last Land, and beyond it, the open sea."
"What to the southwest?"
"Rolamenny, which is one of our East Reach Isles, and some small islets round about it. Then nothing till you enter the South Reach, Rood and Toom and the Isle of the Ear, where men do not go."
"Ah, we may," Ged said wryly.
"I'd rather not. That is a disagreeable part of the world, they say, full of bones and portents. Sailors say that there are stars to be seen from the waters by the Isle of the Ear and Farsor that cannot be seen anywhere else, and that they have never been named."
"Aye, there was a sailor on the ship that brought me first to Roke who spoke of that.
And he told tales of the raft folk in the far south reach, who never come to land but once a year, to cut the great logs for their rafts, and the rest of the year all the days and months they drift on the currents of ocean, out of sight of any land. I'd like to see those raft villages."
"I would not," said Vetch, grinning. "Give me land and land folk. The sea in its bed and I in mine."
"I wish I could have seen all the cities of the archipelago," Ged said as he held the sail rope watching the wide gray wastes before them. "Havnor at the world's heart, and Ea where the myths were born, and Shelioth of the fountains on Wey. All the cities and the great lands and the small lands, the strange lands of the outer reaches, them too, to sail right down the Dragon's Run away in the west, or to sail north into the ice floes, clear to Hoganland. Some say that is a land greater than all the archipelago, and others say it is mere reefs and rocks with ice between. Ah, no one knows, and I should like to see the whales in the northern seas, but I cannot. I must go where I am bound to go, and turn my back on the bright shores. I was in too much haste, and now have no time left. I traded all the sunlight in the cities and the distant lands for a handful of power, for a shadow for the dark. So, as the mage-born will, Ged made his fear and regret into a song, a brief lament, half-sung that was not for himself alone, and his friend, replying, spoke the hero's words from the deed of Erathacpe. "Oh, may I see the earth's bright hearth once more, the white towers of Havnor." So they sailed on their narrow course over the wide forsaken waters. The most they saw that day was a school of silver pannies swimming south, but never a dolphin leaped, nor did the flight of gull or murra or tern break the gray air. As the east darkened and the west grew red, Vetch brought out food and divided it between them and said, "Here's the last of the ale. I drink to the one who thought to put the keg aboard for thirsty men in cold weather, my sister Yarrow." At that Ged left off his bleak thoughts and his gazing ahead over the sea, and he saluted Yarrow more earnestly, perhaps, than Vetch. The thought of her brought to his mind the sense of her wise and childish sweetness. She was not like any person he had known. What young girl had he ever known at all? But he never thought of that. "She is like a little fish, a minnow that swims in a clear creek, defenseless, yet you cannot catch her." At this, Vetch looked straight at him, smiling.
"You are a mage born. Her true name is Kest."
In the old speech, Kest is minnow, as Ged well knew. And this pleased him to the heart. But after a while, he said in a low voice, "You should not have told me her name, maybe." But Vetch, who had not done so lightly, said, "And so lightly," said, "And so lightly."
"Her name is safe with you, as mine is. And besides, you knew it without my telling you."
Red sank to ashes in the west, and ash gray sank to black. All the sea and sky were wholly dark. Ged stretched out in the bottom of the boat to sleep, wrapped in his cloak of wool and fur. Vetch, holding the sail rope, sang softly from the deed of Enlad, where the song tells how the mage Morred the White left Havnor in his oarless longship, and coming to the island Solea saw Elfaran in the orchards in the spring.
Ged slept before the song came to the sorry end of their love, Morad's death, the ruin of Enlad, the sea waves vast and bitter, whelming the orchards of Salea. Towards midnight he woke, and watched again while Vetch slept. The little boat ran sharp over choppy seas, fleeing the strong wind that leaned on her sail, running blind through the night, but the overcast had broken, and before dawn the thin moon shining between brown edge clouds shed a weak light on the sea. "The moon wanes to her dark," Vetch murmured, awake in the dawn when for a while the cold wind dropped. Ged looked up at the white half-ring above the paling eastern waters, but said nothing. The dark of the moon that follows first after sun return is called the fallows, and is the contrary pole of the days of the moon and the long dance in summer. It is an unlucky time for travelers and for the sick. Children are not given their true name during the fallows, and no deeds are sung, nor swords, nor edge-tools sharpened, nor oaths sworn. It is the dark axis of the year when things done are ill done. 3 days out from Sutter's they came, following seabirds and shore wrack, to Pelamar, a small isle humped high above the high gray seas. Its people spoke Hardic, but in their own fashion, strange even to Vetch's ears. The young men came ashore there for fresh water and a respite from the sea, and at first were well received with wonder and commotion. There was a sorcerer in the main town of the island, but he was mad. He would talk only of the great serpent that was eating at the foundations of Pelamar, so that soon the island must go adrift like a boat cut from her moorings and slide out over the edge of the world. At first he greeted the young wizards courteously, but as he talked about the serpent he began to look askance at Ged, and then he fell to railing at them there in the street, calling them spies and servants of the sea snake. The Pelamarians looked dourly at them after that, since though mad, he was their sorcerer. So Ged and Vetch made no long stay, but set forth again before nightfall, going always south and east. In these days and nights of sailing, Ged never spoke of the shadow, nor directly of his quest, and the nearest Vetch came to asking any question was, as they followed the same course farther and farther out and away from the known lands of Earthsea, "Are you sure?" To this Ged answered only, "Is the iron sure where the magnet lies?" Vetch nodded, and they went on, no more being said by either. But from time to time they talked of the crafts and devices that mages of old days had used to find out the hidden name of baneful powers and beings. How Neregar of Paln had learned the black mage's name from overhearing the conversation of dragons, and how Morad had seen his enemy's name written by falling raindrops in the dust of the battlefield of the plains of Enlad. They spoke of finding spells and invocations and those answerable questions which only the master patterner of Roke can ask. But often Ged would end by murmuring words which Ogion had said to him on the shoulder of Gaunt Mountain in an autumn long ago. "To hear, one must be silent." And he would fall silent and ponder, hour by hour, always watching the sea ahead of the boat's way. Sometimes it seemed to Vetch that his friend saw, across the waves and miles and gray days yet to come, the thing they followed and the dark end of their voyage. They passed between Cornay and Gosk in foul weather, seeing neither isle in the fog and rain, and knowing they had passed them only on the next day when they saw ahead of them an isle of pinnacled cliffs, above which seagulls wheeled in huge flocks, whose mewing clamor could be heard from far over the sea. Vetch said, "That will be Astowel from the look of it. Last land. East and south of it, the charts are empty."
"Yet they who live there may know of farther lands."
"Why do you say so?"
Vetch asked, for Ged had spoken uneasily, and his answer to this again was halting and strange. "Not there," he said, gazing at Astowel ahead and past it or through it. Not there. Not on the sea. Not on the sea, but on dry land." "What land?" "For the springs of the open sea, beyond the sources, behind the gates of daylight." Then he fell silent, and when he spoke again it was in an ordinary voice, as if he had been freed from a spell or a vision and had no clear memory of it. The port of Astowel, a creek mouth between rocky heights, was on the northern shore of the isle, and all the huts of the town faced north and west,
It was as if the island turned its face, though from so far away, always towards Earthsea, towards mankind. Excitement and dismay attended the arrival of strangers in a season when no boat had ever braved the seas round Astowel. The women all stayed in the wattle huts, peering out the door, hiding their children behind their skirts, drawing back fearfully into the darkness of the huts as the strangers came up from the beach. The men, lean fellows, ill-clothed against the cold, gathered in a solemn circle about Vetch and Ged, and each one held a stone hand-axe or a knife of shell. But once their fear was past, they made the strangers very welcome, and there was no end to their questions. Seldom did any ship come to them, even from Soders or Rolomeni, they having nothing to trade for bronze or fine wares. They had not even any wood. Their boats were coracles woven of reed, and it was a brave sailor who would go as far as Gosk or Cornay in such a craft. They dwelt all alone here at the edge of all the maps. They had no witch or sorcerer, and seemed not to recognize the young wizard's staffs for what they were, admiring them only for the precious stuff they were made of, wood. Their chief, or isleman, was very old, and he alone of his people had ever before seen a man born in the archipelago. Ged, therefore, was a marvel to them. The men brought their little sons to look at the archipelago, so they might remember him when they were old. They had never heard of Gaunt, only of Havnor and Ea, and took him for a lord of Havnor. He did his best to answer their questions about the white city he had never seen, but he was restless as the evening wore on, and at last he asked the men of the village, as they sat crowded round the fire pit, in the lodge house, in the reeking warmth of the goat dung and broom faggots that were all their fuel, what lies eastward of your land? They were silent, some grinning, others grim. The old isle man answered, "The sea? There is no land beyond?" "This is last land. There is no land beyond. There is nothing but water till the world's edge." "These are wise men, father. These are wise men, father. These are wise men," said a younger man. "Seafarers, voyagers. Maybe they know of a land we do not know of."
"There is no land east of this land,"
said the old man, and he looked long at Ged and spoke no more to him. The companions slept that night in the smoky warmth of the lodge. Before daylight, Ged roused his friend, whispering, "Estariel, wake. We cannot stay. We must go."
"Why so soon?"
Vetch asked, full of sleep. "Not soon. Late. I have followed too slow. It has found the way to escape me, and so doom me. It must not escape me, for I must follow it however far it goes. If I lose it, I am lost."
"Where do we follow it?"
"Eastward. Come, fill the water skins." So they left the lodge before any in the village was awake, except a baby that cried a little in the darkness of some hut, and fell still again. By the vague starlight they found the way down to the creek mouth and untied Lookfar from the rock cairn where she had been made fast, and pushed her out into the black water. So they set out eastward, from Astowel into the open sea, on the first day of the fallows, before sunrise. That day they had clear skies. The world's wind was cold and gusty from the northeast, but Ged had raised the mage wind, the first act of magery he had done since he left the Isle of the Hands. And they sailed very fast due eastward. The boat shuddered with the great smoking sunlit waves that hit her as she ran, but she went gallantly as her builder had promised, answering the mage wind as true as any spell-inwoven ship of Roke. Ged spoke not at all that morning, except to renew the power of the wind spell or to keep a charmed strength in the sail. And Vetch finished his sleep, though uneasily, in the stern of the boat. At noon they ate. Ged doled their food sparingly, and the portent of this was plain, but both of them chewed their bit of salt fish and wheaten cake, and neither said anything. All afternoon they cleaved eastward, never turning nor slackening pace. Once Ged broke his silence, saying, "Do you hold with those who think the world is all landless sea beyond the outer reaches? Or with those who imagine other archipelagos or vast undiscovered lands on the other face of the world?"
"At this time, I hold with those who think the world has but one face, and he who sails too far will fall off the edge of it."
Ged did not smile. There was no mirth left in him. Who knows what a man might meet out there? Not we, who keep always to our coasts and shores.
Some have sought to know, and have not returned, and no ship has ever come to us from lands we do not know.
Ged made no reply. All that day, all that night, they went, driven by the powerful wind of Majory over the great swells of ocean, eastward. And Ged kept watch from dusk till dawn, for in darkness the force that drew or drove him grew stronger, yet always he watched ahead, though his eyes in the moonless night could see no more than the painted eyes aside the boat's blind prow. By daybreak his dark face was gray with weariness, and he was so cramped with cold that he could hardly stretch out to rest. He said, whispering, "Hold the mage wind from the west, Astariel." And then he slept. There was no sunrise, and presently rain came beating across the bow from the northeast. It was no storm, only the long, cold winds and rains of winter. Soon all things in the open boat were wet through, despite the sailcloth cover they had bought, and Vetch felt as if he too were soaked clear to the bone, and Ged shivered in his sleep. In pity for his friend and perhaps for himself, Vetch tried to turn aside for a little that rude, ceaseless wind that bore the rain. But, though following Ged's will, he could keep the mage wind strong and steady. His weatherworking had small power here so far from land, and the wind of the open sea did not listen to his voice. And at this a certain fear came into Vetch, as he began to wonder how much wizardly power would be left to him and Ged if they went on and on away from the lands where men were meant to live. Ged watched again that night, and all night held the boat eastward. When day came, the world's wind slackened somewhat, and the sun shone fitfully. But the great swells ran so high that Lookfar must tilt and climb up them as if they were hills, and hang at the hill crest, and plunge suddenly, and climb up the next again, and the next, unending. In the evening of that day, Vetch spoke out of long silence. "My friend, you spoke once as if sure we would come to land at last. I would not question your vision but for this, that it might be a trick, a deception made by that which you follow, to lure you on farther than a man can go over ocean, for our power may change and weaken on strange seas, and a shadow does not tire or starve or drown." They sat side by side on the thwart, yet Ged looked at him now as if from a distance across a wide abyss. His eyes were troubled and he was slow to answer. At last he said, "Astariel, we are coming near." Hearing his words, his friend knew them to be true. He was afraid then, but he put his hand on Ged's shoulder and said only, "Well then, good. That is good." Again that night Ged watched, for he could not sleep in the dark, nor would he sleep when the third day came. Still they ran with that ceaseless light, terrible swiftness over the sea, and Vetch wondered at Ged's power that could hold so strong a mage wind hour after hour here on the open sea, where Vetch felt his own power all weakened and astray. And they went on, until it seemed to Vetch that what Ged had spoken would come true, and they were going beyond the sources of the sea, and eastward behind the gates of daylight. Ged stayed forward in the boat, looking ahead as always, but he was not watching the ocean now. Or not the ocean that Vetch saw, a waste of heaving water to the rim of the sky. In Ged's eyes, there was a dark vision that overlapped and veiled the gray sea and the gray sky, and the darkness grew and the veil thickened. None of this was visible to Vetch, except when he looked at his friend's face. Then he, too, saw the darkness for a moment. And they went on, and it was as if the one wind drove them in one boat. Vetch went east over the world sea, while Ged went alone into a realm where there was no east or west, no rising or setting of the sun or of the stars. Ged stood up suddenly in the prow and spoke aloud. The mage wind dropped. Lookfar lost headway and rose and fell on the vast surges like a chip of wood. Though the world's wind blew strong as ever straight from the north now, the brown sail hung slack, unstirred. And so the boat hung on the waves, swung by their great slow swinging, but going no direction. Ged said, "Take down the sail." And Vetch did so quickly, while Ged unlashed the oars and set them in the locks and bent his back to rowing. Vetch, seeing only the waves heaving up and down clear to the end of sight, could not understand why they went now by oars, but he waited. And presently he was aware that the world's wind was growing faint, and the swells diminishing. The climb and plunge of the boat grew less and less,
till at last she seemed to go forward under Ged's strong oar strokes over water that lay almost still, as in a landlocked bay. And though Vetch could not see what Ged saw, when between his strokes he looked ever and again over his shoulder at what lay before the boat's way, though Vetch could not see the dark slopes beneath unmoving stars, yet he began to see with his wizard's eye a darkness that welled up in the hollows of the waves all around the boat, and he saw the billows grow low and sluggish as they were choked with sand. If this were an enchantment of illusion, it was powerful beyond belief. To make the open sea seem land? Trying to collect his wits and courage, Vetch spoke the revelation spell, watching between each slow-syllabled word for change or tremor of illusion in this strange drying and shallowing of the abyss of ocean. But there was none. Perhaps the spell, though it should affect only his own vision and not the magic at work about them, had no power here. Or perhaps there was no illusion, and they had come to world's end. Unheeding, Ged rowed always slower, looking over his shoulder, choosing a way among channels or shoals and shallows that he alone could see. The boat shuddered as her keel dragged, yet under that keel lay the vast deeps of the sea, yet they were aground. Ged drew the oars up, rattling in their locks, and that noise was terrible, for there was no other sound. All sounds of water, wind, wood, sail were gone, lost in a huge, profound silence that might have been unbroken forever. The boat lay motionless. No breath of wind moved. The sea had turned to sand, shadowy, unstirred. Nothing moved in the dark sky or on that dry, unreal ground that went on and on into gathering darkness all around the boat as far as I could see. Ged stood up and took his staff and lightly stepped over the side of the boat. Vetch thought to see him fall and sink down in the sea that surely was there behind this dry, dim veil that hid away water, sky, and light. But there was no sea anymore. Ged walked away from the boat. The dark sand showed his footprints where he went and whispered a little under his step. His staff began to shine, not with the werelight, but with a clear, white glow that soon grew so bright that it reddened his fingers where they held the radiant wood. He strode forward away from the boat, but in no direction. There were no directions here, no north or south or east or west, only towards and away. To Vetch, watching, the light he bore seemed like a great slow star that moved through the darkness, and the darkness about it thickened, blackened, drew together. This also Ged saw, watching always ahead through the light, and after a while he saw, at the faint outermost edge of the light, a shadow that came towards him over the sand. At first it was shapeless, but as it drew nearer it took on the look of a man. An old man, it seemed, gray and grim, coming towards Ged. But even as Ged saw his father, the smith, in that figure, he saw that it was not an old man, but a young one. It was Jasper. Jasper's insolent, handsome young face and silver-clasped gray cloak and stiff stride. Hateful was the look he fixed on Ged across the dark intervening air. Ged did not stop, but slowed his pace, and as he went forward he raised his staff a little higher. It brightened, and in its light the look of Jasper fell from the figure that approached, and it became Petchvere. But Petchvere's face was all bloated and pallid like the face of a drowned man, and he reached out his hand strangely, as if beckoning.
Stilged did not stop, but went forward, though there were only a few yards left between them now. And then the thing that faced him changed utterly, spreading out to either side as if it opened enormous thin wings, and it writhed and swelled and shrank again. Ged saw in it for an instant Skjor's white face, and then a pair of clouded, staring eyes, and then suddenly a fearful face he did not know, man or monster, with writhing lips and eyes that were like pits going back into black emptiness. At that, Ged lifted up the staff high, and the radiance of it brightened intolerably, burning with so white and great a light that it compelled and harrowed even that ancient darkness. In that light, all form of man sloughed off the thing that came towards Ged. It drew together and shrank and blackened, crawling on four short taloned legs upon the sand, but still it came forward, lifting up to him a blind, unformed snout without lips or ears or eyes. As they came right together, it became utterly black in the white mage radiance that burned about it, and it heaved itself upright. In silence, man and shadow met face to face and stopped. Aloud and clearly, breaking that old silence, Ged spoke the shadow's name. And in the same moment, the shadow spoke without lips or tongue, saying the same word. Ged! And the two voices were one voice. Ged reached out his hands, dropping his staff, and took hold of his shadow, of the black self that reached out to him. Light and darkness met and joined and were one. But to Vetch, watching in terror through the dark twilight from off over the sand, it seemed that Ged was overcome, for he saw the clear radiance fail and grow dim. Rage and despair filled him, and he sprang out on the sand to help his friend or die with him, and ran towards that small fading glimmer of light in the empty dusk of the dry land. But as he ran, the sand sank under his feet, and he struggled in it as in quicksand, as though a heavy flow of water, until with a roar of noise and a glory of daylight and the bitter cold of winter and the bitter taste of salt, the world was restored to him, and he floundered in the sudden, true, and living sea. Nearby the boat rocked on the gray waves, empty. Vetch could see nothing else on the water. The battering wave tops filled his eyes and blinded him. No strong swimmer, he struggled as best he could to the boat and pulled himself up into her, coughing and trying to wipe away the water that streamed from his hair. He looked about desperately, not knowing now which way to look. And at last he made out something dark among the waves, a long way off across what had been sand, and now was wild water. Then he leaped to the oars and rowed mightily to his friend, and catching Ged's arms helped and hauled him up over the side. Ged was dazed, and his eyes stared as if they saw nothing. But there was no hurt to be seen on him. His staff, black yew wood, all radiance quenched, was grasped in his right hand, and he would not let go of it. He said no word. Spent and soaked and shaking, he lay huddled up against the mast, never looking at Vetch, who raised the sail and turned the boat to catch the northeast wind. He saw nothing of the world until, straight ahead of their course, in the sky that darkened where the sun had set, between long clouds in a bay of clear blue light, the new moon shone, a ring of ivory, a rim of horn, reflected sunlight shining across the ocean of the dark. Ged lifted his face and gazed at that remote, bright crescent in the west. He gazed for a long time, and then he stood up, erect, holding his staff in his two hands as a warrior holds his longsword. He looked about at the sky, the sea, the brown swelling sail above him, his friend's face. "Astario, look, it is done. It is over. The wound is healed. I am whole. I am free." Then he bent and hid his face in his arms, weeping like a boy. Until that moment, Vetch had watched him with an anxious dread, for he was not sure what had happened there in the Darkland. He did not know if this was Ged in the boat with him, and his hand had been for hours ready to the anchor to stave in the boat's planking and sink her there in mid-sea, rather than carry back to the harbors of Earthsea the evil thing that he feared might have taken Ged's look and form. Now, when he saw his friend and heard him speak, his doubt vanished, and he began to see the truth, that Ged had neither lost nor won, but, naming the shadow of his death with his own name, had made himself whole. A man who, knowing his whole true self, cannot be used or possessed by any power other than himself, and whose life, therefore, is lived for life's sake, and never in the service of ruin, or pain, or hatred, or the dark. In the creation of Ea, which is the oldest song, it is said, "Only in silence the word, only in dark the light, only in dying life, bright the hawk's flight on the empty sky." That song Vetch sang aloud now as he held the boat westward, going before the cold wind of the winter night that blew at their backs from the vastness of the open sea.
8 days they sailed, and eight again, before they came in sight of land. Many times they had to refill their waterskin with spell-sweetened water of the sea, and they fished. But even when they called out fishermen's charms, they caught very little, for the fish of the open sea do not know their own names, and pay no heed to magic. And when they had nothing left to eat but a few scraps of smoked meat, Ged remembered what Yarrow had said when he stole the cake from the hearth, that he would regret his theft when he came to hunger on the sea. But hungry as he was, the remembrance pleased him, for she had also said that he, with her brother, would come home again. The mage wind had borne them for only 3 days eastward, yet 16 days they sailed westward to return. No men have ever returned from so far out on the open sea, as did the young wizards, Astariol and Ged, in the fallows of winter in their open fishing boat. They met no great storms, and steered steadily enough by the compass and by the star Tolvagren, taking a course somewhat northward of their outbound way. Thus they did not come back to Astowel, but passing by Fartolly and Sneg without sighting them, first raised land off the southernmost cape of Kopish. Over the waves they saw cliffs of stone rise like a great fortress. Seabirds cried, wheeling over the breakers, and smoke of the hearth fires of small villages drifted blue on the wind. From there the voyage to Ifish was not long, and they came into Ismay Harbor on a still, dark evening before snow. They tied up the boat, Lookfar, that had borne them to the coasts of Death's Kingdom and back, and went up through the narrow streets to the wizard's house. Their hearts were very light as they entered into the firelight and warmth under that roof, and Yarrow ran to meet them, crying with joy.
"Listen. If Astariol of Ifish kept his promise and made a song of that first great deed of Ged's, it has been lost. There is a tale told in the East Reach of a boat that ran aground days out from any shore over the abyss of ocean. In Ifish, they say it was Astariol who sailed that boat. but in Tuk, they say it was two fishermen blown by a storm far out on the open sea. And in Holp, the tale is of a Holpish fisherman, and tells that he couldn't move his boat from the unseen sands it grounded on, and so wanders there yet. So, of the Song of the Shadow, there remain only a few scraps of legend, carried like driftwood from isle to isle over the long years. But in the Deed of Ged, nothing is told of that voyage, nor of Ged's meeting with the Shadow, before ever he sailed the Dragon's Run unscathed, or brought back the ring of Erith Akbe from the tombs of Atuan to Havnor, or came at last to Roke once more as Archmage of all the islands of the world.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.